For centuries, farmers have been clearing the land before planting their crops. For centuries, farmers have been struggling to maintain soil fertility. This hour, revolutionary ideas about agriculture and soil science. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Global climate change is a reality. Farmers everywhere work hard to get the most out of their land. And as the world population continues to grow, concerns about hunger also rise. What if there was a solution that would help reverse climate change, help farmers, and increase the productivity of the land? Kristen Olson believes that solution exists. She's the author of The Soil Will Save Us, and I'll talk with her. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Efforts to combat climate change have focused mostly on changing human behavior when it comes to consumption of fossil fuels and on making industry cleaner and more accountable. But Kristen Olson believes that the answer lies beneath our feet. She is the author of The Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. And she is with us today. Hello, Kristen.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
And this story starts not with an overabundance of carbon in our atmosphere, the key problem identified when it comes to climate change, but with a lack of carbon in our soil. Tell me where you begin.
Where I began. I began following this story when a chef who's very much involved in local sustainable produce started telling me about these farmers that he was talking to who were doing something they called carbon farming or sunlight farming. The whole point of their farming was to build up carbon in the soil that's been lost through not only conventional farming, but through all of agriculture. Our soils are an immense sink for carbon, but they are not the sink that they used to be. Over billions of years, carbon has built up in the soil. Plants have been on land for a half a billion years, and plants remove carbon dioxide from the air, turn it into a carbon fuel, and share that carbon fuel with microorganisms that are in the soil that fix it there. But when humans started conducting agriculture and especially plowing, we started to release that carbon that had been built up in the soil.
Okay, and of course, plowing the land, clearing the land and planting crops is something that farmers have been doing for centuries. And in that traditional setup, when a farmer plants his or her crops, the crops grow, they're harvested, and the soil loses something, right?
Well, it's in the plowing. It's in the plowing and the clearing land that the soil loses carbon. When that carbon is fixed in the soil, but when plowing comes and opens up the soil and exposes soil to oxygen, that carbon that's held in the soil will volatilize and blow away. So yes, agriculture that plants and plows without giving anything back to those soil microorganisms does deplete the soil of carbon.
And we've seen this again for centuries where people have farmed land in a particular place for a while and then the land becomes less fertile and they move on to another place.
Right, and that has been the pattern of agriculture for thousands and thousands of years. The problem now is that there aren't very many other places to move on to, and there are so many of us, and there's so much land that is used for agriculture that we can't afford to do that anymore.
Now, when we talk about soil fertility, usually here in Iowa, we talk a lot about nitrogen. Where does carbon fit into that story?
Well, it's not just that carbon fits into that story. It's that the community of soil microorganisms fits into that story. So in a teaspoon of decent soil, scientists have estimated that there are 6 billion microorganisms, and they're very, very, very busy there. And they have been conducting an ancient partnership, as I call it in the book, an ancient partnership with plants for a half a billion years. So that by the terms of that ancient partnership, plants are taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and they are converting it into a carbon fuel. And then they share some 40% of that carbon fuel with soil microorganisms through their roots. The role of the soil microorganisms, their terms of the partnership, is that they have enzymes that liberate nutrients from rock and sand and silt and clay. They bring those nutrients to the plants in exchange. I mean, it's a little more complicated than that, but in exchange for that carbon. And it's those soil microorganisms that make nitrogen and other nutrients available to plants. So if that community of soil microorganisms isn't there and functioning, it's very difficult for plants to access those nutrients.
So when we went through one of our big crises in the world of agriculture and the Green Revolution came along, which allowed farmers to continue to farm the land that they were already farming, and it allowed farmers all over the world to grow much more food on the land that they were farming and undoubtedly save lives all over the world. This Green Revolution made it possible for us to continue doing what we were doing. It didn't do anything for the microorganisms in our soil.
It didn't do anything for the microorganisms in our soil, and, you know, it was a temporary fix. I think that the new science that's really looking at these complicated relationships that exist in nature are showing that we can have farms that are as productive without using what is best called regenerative agriculture. I'm not as fond of the term organic, but regenerative agriculture, agriculture that respects those partnerships in nature and works with them. So when we work with those partnerships, we can have productive land, and we don't have the huge environmental damage that we're seeing from the chemicals and the deep tilling and all those other things that have come to us largely through the Green Revolution. I mean, there is a study that was done in 2004 by Iowa State researchers saying that $5 to $16 billion is spent every year by our government to clean up after industrial agriculture. I would rather see money like that going to farmers to help them work with those natural partnerships and farm in a healthier way.
Throughout the book, you profile a number of different people who've done a great deal of research in this field and are putting a lot of these ideas into practice. And one of the first people that you introduce us to in the book, and pardon me if I say his name incorrectly, is Ratan Lal, who is at Ohio State University. And I think his path to discovering how this relationship between all these microorganisms in the soil and the relationship with carbon is fascinating. Can you tell me a little bit about his path?
He was, a brilliant scientist who was sent to Africa to try to help farmers there farm in a more sustainable way. So what they were doing, they did slash and burn agriculture. They would, you know, burn down a part of the forest, grow crops there, and after, you know, a number of years, that land would just be dead, and they would just move on. But as I said earlier, you know, with more and more people, you cannot continue to farm in that way. So he was trying to help farmers there change their practices so that they could grow enough food but not ruin the land. And he was failing. He wasn't getting those relationships between the soil microorganisms and the plants, and that is pretty recent science. So he was visited there by a climate scientist who was looking at his failed plots, and Ratan Lal said, "Oh, if I could only get the carbon back in that soil." And the climate scientist said, "Well, where do you think that carbon is?" And Ratan Lal said, "I don't know. I just want to put it back." And the climate scientist pointed out that a lot of that carbon that was in the soils had volatilized, and it was up in the atmosphere and contributing to global warming. So that really marked a turning point in Ratan Lal's career. He, you know, I think that before that, mostly soil scientists had looked at the soil in terms of its physical characteristics and its chemical characteristics, but not its biological life. And that really was a turning point for him. He started talking to people around the world, and has been ever since, about how to heal the land through better agriculture.
And also carbon fixing through agriculture as well. Carbon fixing,
Correct.
And I've heard many different stories over the years about the ideas about carbon fixing, some of them just injecting carbon into our soil and trying to keep it there. But this is carbon fixing through a natural process of growing crops.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny, you know, all those schemes about using complicated technology and machines to suck carbon dioxide out of the air and transfer it deep into the ground through other forms of technology and machinery, it's kind of amusing when you realize that we have these things called plants, and they do that for free. They are the conduit for carbon between the skies and the earth, and they do that for free. And they do that on a massive scale all over the earth already. The point is that we need to work with those natural processes, those natural partnerships, to help plants do that more and to restore those communities of soil microorganisms.
Okay, so let's talk on a practical level about what this looks like. And we're going to bring a farmer into the conversation in just a few minutes. But I'm sure there are people right now, Kristen, thinking this sounds too good to be true. So let's talk nuts and bolts about in an agricultural operation, what does this look like?
What it looks like is a lot of things put together, and that's why I don't really like to use the term organic, because organic is a legal term that, you know, focuses on certain issues. But basically what healthy land looks like in nature is it's land that is covered densely with a pelt of vegetation. It's land that is covered with a highly diverse kind of vegetation. So those, when we drive out in the countryside and see miles and miles of corn or soybean or wheat growing and nothing else growing, that is completely in violation of what nature considers, not to anthropomorphize nature, but what is viable in a natural system. So, and for the most part, you don't see bare areas in natural systems. That's, you know, disturbed soils, soils that are open to the element. Those are things that humans have done. So basically, those are the principles. In addition, you know, natural areas have evolved with animal impact. The great grasslands of the world evolved with herds of roaming ruminants. So in a lot of the farms that are practicing this regenerative agriculture and getting very, very great yields without the terrible environmental costs and also the financial costs of conventional agriculture, what you're seeing is land that is densely covered with vegetation. It's covered with diverse vegetation. There's not a lot of bare land, and they're using animals to make the land healthier.
We have to take a short break. We'll be back. We'll talk more about this in just a moment. I'm talking right now with Kristen Olson. She is the author of The Soil Will Save Us. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Kristen Olson. She is the author of The Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. We're talking about soil science this hour. We're talking about agriculture and new ideas and some old ideas in agriculture, and also the relationship between these ideas in soil science and agriculture and climate change, the idea that we could actually remove carbon from the atmosphere and create healthier soil, create better yields for farmers, and a healthier planet for everyone. Again, Kristen Olson is with me. And Kristen, just before the break, we were talking about sort of the nuts and bolts of what this looks like on a farm, these ideas in practice. And you were talking about a farm that's covered densely with vegetation. So we're talking about cover crops and no-till practices, the idea that at no time will the fields be bare, right?
Right.
And then we also talked about a variety of vegetation. So are you focusing on the idea of having more diverse crops, or can we grow corn and soybeans in this way?
Well, the farmer that I profiled in my book, whose name is Gabe Brown, and he's in North Dakota, He is growing corn this way, but he's growing corn with very, very strategic and careful cover crops growing between the corn. He uses what's called a cover crop cocktail. So a lot of people, when they use cover crops, and cover crops have been used by farmers for hundreds, if not thousands of years, because they understood that the cover crops would protect the soil from wind and rain erosion, water erosion. But the new science is not only affirming that those are very valuable characteristics for cover crops, but what cover crops are also doing is preventing bare soil. When you have bare soil, there's no photosynthesis going on. So what the cover crops are doing are pumping a variety, and especially when you have a variety of cover crops, like Gabe Brown, the farmer I profile, mm-hmm. he has 15, 16, 30 different kinds of cover crops going on in his fields. So they are pumping a diversity of exudates down to the soil microorganisms. They're feeding those soil microorganisms all the time and keeping those underground systems healthy.
And you also brought up the idea of livestock being involved in this balance. And with concerns about overgrazing in the past, the traditional method of rejuvenating the land has been to, you know, sort of let it be grazed down to the point where there's nothing left, and then removing the livestock and letting it bounce back. And that works to a degree in many places, particularly in this part of the world, but not in Africa, not in many places in Africa is what was found, that if something was overgrazed and then left alone, it wouldn't bounce back. So tell me a little bit about what we know about the integration of livestock into these environments and how the livestock can actually help to heal the land.
Yeah, it was interesting. When I was in North Dakota doing research for the book, I met with a biologist from Ducks Unlimited, and he was pointing out how the areas that had been removed from any sort of agriculture, where cattle weren't even grazing, were much less healthy than the areas where cattle were being grazed in a sustainable way. So what we know is that these grasslands did evolve with animal impact, but that the kind of grazing that we have done so often through human history, which is just to remove predators and fence in animals and let the animals just graze the way they want to, they will graze good grasses down until they're dead. So what really careful farmers and ranchers are doing now is that they move their animals over the land in a way that mimics the behavior of those ancient herds, so that the animals are having a beneficial impact on the land with their hooves, with their dung, with their urine, and stimulating plant growth by biting on it, but not leaving them there long enough so that they destroy grasses, moving them on so that the grass can complete its own natural cycle of regrowth. So that's what a lot of these careful farmers and ranchers are doing. And on these farms where these regenerative farms where they're including animal impact as one of the tools to make the land healthy, they will, after a field has been harvested, they will run their cattle through that field to clean it up and to contribute their own fertilizer and to stomp those remaining bits of plant material down into the ground, all of which is really great for the soil microorganisms. In fact, the farmer Gabe Brown that I profiled in my book, he always says that he has two herds on his property. He has the herd of cattle above ground, which he sells at a very nice profit because it's great beef. But he has the herd of microorganisms under the ground. And he says that when he thinks about how to manage his land, he's always thinking about what that herd of microorganisms underground really needs.
Interesting. Kristen Olson is with me. She is the author of The Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. And I want to bring an Iowa farmer into this conversation now. Paul Ackley is a farmer in southwestern Iowa in Taylor County. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
And I know that you've been a farmer for a long time. You started out as what we call a conventional farmer. You grew up in a family. You farmed conventionally. When did you start to think about doing things in a different way?
Oh, probably when we started no-till. That was different at the time. And I also noticed since we were in a rotation when I grew up, we had hay and oats and pasture and row crops, and I noticed that we were losing something when we stayed with row crops so long. And even with the addition of extra fertilizer, you didn't get that plant health that you saw in a crop of corn planted in sod.
So when did you start a no-till operation? When did that idea come to you?
We began to no-till, I think, in the we bought the no-till planter in the 80s, and it took a while to get my mind adapted to it, like 5 or 6 years. And we haven't tilled anything since 2000.
Wow. Well, and that was, Kristen, that was one of the kind of funny passages in your book. One of the farmers that you profile, when he went no-till, another farmer who was mentoring him said, "You've got to sell your plow."
Right.
Or you'll be too tempted to go back. And Paul, was that a temptation that was hard to get past?
It really didn't bother me a lot. I guess we used the disc more, but it really is the best way to do it because you don't need it anymore. Your mind just has to adapt.
So what about it convinced you that it was the right way to go? What did you start to see? And you know, we're just talking about this step, the no-till step. What did you see that convinced you that that was the right direction?
It reduced erosion. It cut fuel use. It gave us more time to spend with the livestock.
So it was actually easier?
Yes, it was very much easier.
And as time went on, did you then think, okay, if this is working well, what else can I do?
I begin to see that it had some shortcomings. Crops, there's about a 5 or 6 year adaptation process, it seems like, and things weren't shining like I would like for them to, and where we'd had, if we broke out a hay field or something, the crop was always better on it. Also, we had started working with cereal rye a little bit for back in the mid-70s, and I knew what it would do as far as control erosion and weed control.
Okay, and cereal rye as a cover crop.
Yes, ma'am.
And so you have been really intensively using cover crops since 2009.
That is true. We've had nearly all of our row crop acres with a cover crop of some kind to hold the soil in place. And we also added a small grain to our rotation at that same time. And it's harvested about the first week of July. We'll come back in about 2 weeks and plant a diverse cover crop with a grazing forage sorghum. We're using an 8-way mix this year, but it really doesn't, there's no set recipe for that. It's kind of what you want to do.
For some people listening, Paul, talking about this is probably going over their heads, talking about cover crops. Can you tell me what the benefits of planting a cover crop are for you?
For me, on the land that we farm, soil erosion.
Okay, so reduced. It keeps the soil in place.
That is the first one. Mm-hmm. I mean, secondly, we suppress weeds, and then we stimulate the biological life, and the soil begins to behave differently. Water infiltrates more readily. We can reduce some of the inputs that we've been using. But the biological life thing, we haven't taken it a long ways. We have started doing some PLFA testing, which is phospholipids and fatty acids test to reveal, you know, the concentration of life in the soil. And we're starting to track that on some pieces.
And when you talk about using a cover crop to suppress weeds, I mean, for a lot of us, we think anything in a corn or a soybean field that's not corn or soybeans is a weed. So I can see it being a little counterintuitive to think about. But if you plant the cover crop, that crowds out some of the more dangerous weeds that could get into your fields?
Yes, we try to terminate the cover crop approximate planting time. Sometimes it's after and sometimes it's before. It depends on the weather. But it needs to grow and produce a good amount of biomass to really do a good job of suppressing weeds. But it does provide a lot of competition for the weeds when it's growing, and definitely.
And how do you terminate the cover crop?
Typically, ours have been by spraying. And I'm hoping someday that we're looking at the day when we don't use so much herbicide or
right
have to terminate in that manner.
You've also diversified your operation with some livestock. Why have you made that decision?
Livestock have been a part of the operation, I guess, ever since I've been here. But we have land that is best used by livestock. It's fields would be small and take a lot of dollars to do the conservation work, excuse me, so that they could be row cropped. We also like to run the livestock behind the crop in the crop aftermath, especially the corn. And then we're planting a grazing crop actually behind our wheat, and we can get several grazing days per acre in the fall or winter from that crop, which reduces our hay.
Okay, and what do you feel that having sheep or cows in the field in between a crop rotation, does that enhance the soil, do you feel?
Oh, yes, I do. They walk over the stalks, and there sure isn't any need for a stalk chopper or a chopping head. They eat parts of it. They just work down into the soil, so it's more readily available for them. Microorganisms and earthworms to work on. And plus, they leave their own excrement there and
right.
Leave about 90% of their nutrients in the field.
So you've obviously done a lot of research, and I'm sure you've talked to a lot of other farmers and gotten a lot of ideas. Do you feel like farming this way is more work for you, or is it less work than the way you were farming before?
I think the workload is spread out more. When we added the third crop, that gave us some days in the fall that we would have been harvesting corn if I'd been in corn or beans. It's probably more physical work. We move polywire, give the cows a free new grass approximately every 24 hours. It doesn't take long, but it's no more to turn them into an 80 acres and go check them once a week.
How has it worked out for you economically? I mean, farming is a business, and you obviously need to make a profit. How has that come down?
Yes, it is a business, but it also has to regenerate and rebuild soil, and it has to be socially acceptable. But I really think we probably make as much money. I know we don't spend as much, and probably the thing that we should watch more is the difference between what we spend and what we take in, because we get all excited about big yields or $8 a bushel, but it's actually the difference between our expenses and our sales, our income, that is what we get to live on. And we have reduced our expenses a lot. I mean, there are a lot of things we don't do anymore. We don't use insecticides on the cattle or wormers. That's been since 2008. So, and I thought everything would fall in a heap, but it hasn't. There are other things that you can do. Moving them to new fresh pasture every day helps with that a lot.
You mentioned it being socially acceptable. How have your fellow farmers reacted to the changes that you've made?
I haven't had any negative things. I think sometimes people wonder. I don't visit with them a lot about what we're doing unless they ask. I think maybe as farmers we need to be more aware of what some of the people in the cities are thinking of what we're doing. If they have trouble getting clean water and they look at the river and it looks like a running chocolate shake, it doesn't take them very long to figure out where that came from.
Paul, we're going to have to take a short break, but I want you to stay with us. And Kristen is still with us as well. I'm talking with Paul Ackley. He's a farmer in southwestern Iowa in Taylor County. Kristen Olson is here. She's the author of the book, The Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. And you're welcome to join the conversation as well with your questions and your comments. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about soil science, agriculture, and global warming. And you are welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Kristen Olson. She is the author of The Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. Paul Ackley is also with us. He is a farmer in southwestern Iowa in Taylor County. He farms corn and soybeans. He does small grain, wheat, some hay. He also has cows and sheep, and he's been no-till since 2000. He's also been doing intensive cover crops since 2009 and using a lot of the ideas that Kristen writes about in her book. Again, you're welcome to join our conversation with your questions and your comments. And Paul, I want to ask you, you know, this has been quite an adventure for you. It sounds like it's been quite an educational experience for you. What makes it worthwhile to you to have gone through all of these changes?
I think the fact that a lot of facts, but one of them is we're not so dependent on our input suppliers. Another thing.
And when we talk about inputs for people who don't farm.
We're talking about fertilizer, herbicide, insecticide.
Right.
Or I am. Mm-hmm. The other thing probably is there are some young fellows who have picked up on this, and that's rewarding.
So you're having an influence on other farmers.
Right.
What kind of changes have you seen in your own land?
I've seen the organic matter go from 2.5 to 4.
Okay, and that's the percentage in your soil?
Yes, that's the percentage in the soil. I've seen our cation exchange capacity gradually work up, which means the soil can hold more nutrients. I've seen, even when we stubbed our toe sometimes and the cover crop got killed with frost or something, I've seen less erosion when we had a rain event just because the soil had some structure. Mm-hmm. And it had some residue on top of it. I have found that it's getting harder and harder to keep residue on top of the soil year-round, and I had never even thought that would ever be a problem, but it is. It's being digested away by the microorganisms.
Oh, interesting. Do you find that when you run into a problem like that, Do you have the resources you need to work on a problem? Who do you turn to?
I guess that's a question I hadn't anticipated at all, but we have some people. I call Gabe occasionally, and there's Gail Fuller in Kansas. It's amazing. You develop kind of a network of people, but I spent some time with in Nebraska in June with Ray Archuleta and some other fellows out there.
Right. So there are people you can mine for their wisdom and learn from.
Yes, it's not totally on your own. Like, I guess I went to the National No-Till Conference in 2007 and heard Glenn Beck. And then I started going to things in the winter, conferences and whatnot, and then things began to move quicker at home because I had a diversity of information. And it was not just my trial and error here at home. And you couldn't read much about this until about 5 years ago. There wasn't much in the popular press.
Right. And Kristen, in profiling the farmers in your book, you tell this story. This is something that started very small, but there is a growing community of farmers who are interested in trying out these ideas.
Oh, very much so. And one of the things that I was so impressed about is that there are more and more conferences of farmers talking about these issues. I mean, and since my book came out, I keep hearing from different conference organizers who are addressing these issues. I think that the interest is growing for so many reasons. You know, farmers want to live on healthier land. Farmers want to be healthier and not deal in those chemicals quite so much. Farmers are also knowledgeable that consumers want cleaner food. We want better produced food. And I think it is a challenge for farmers to hear about this stuff, and it's still, even though there are these conferences and even though the internet exists, which puts information out there, and they are challenged because, you know, if they went to ag school and if they grew up in a farming family, you know, the deep plowing and the chemical application, all the basics of industrial farming, that's what they were taught. That's what they were told they needed to do to be successful. But it is a growing number of farmers who are discovering that there's a whole different way of being successful.
We have a tweet from Chris Jackson, and he says, "It seems like uber liberals promoting these alternative methods forget that the industrialization of agriculture was a direct result of big government." And I don't want to get into a political discussion today, but you do write about the Farm Bill and how it works. In fact, you quote one of my former colleagues, Kathleen Masterson, in work she did for Iowa Public Radio in researching the Farm Bill and how it works with farmers. And you find that in many ways, the cards are stacked against farmers who want to make these changes. Why is that?
I think Paul could probably speak to that better than I can, honestly.
Paul, do you want to dip your toe in there?
Well, tradition. I'm not an expert on political things, but boy, when you try to move something political, it causes all kinds of repercussions. But crop insurance is a good example. There were restrictions and whatnot, and one man practically gave 2 years of his life because he got wrong side of the rules.
Okay,
but the rules have now changed.
The rules have now changed to make this a little bit easier?
Yes, they have.
Okay. But for a while, if you were doing some of these alternative methods, you couldn't get crop insurance.
You couldn't get it, or you were in violation of you were planting into a living cover crop or something, and that was a no-no. Or you had radishes and turnips, and that was a vegetable crop. No matter that they weren't good to eat or anything for humans, they were still considered vegetables, and that was a no-no. On the learning side, I think the computer is what really turned me loose. We got a computer in 07 or 06, and I stumbled onto Christine Jones's website. totally different. You know, she was talking about building topsoil, and I thought it took 1,000 years. And
you've been seeing it build on your farm.
We have.
So, Kristen, do you get the sense that things are changing so that farmers have smaller obstacles to get into these kind of conversations and these kinds of ideas? I mean, we're not just, as Paul can attest, we're not talking about the kind of stereotypical small CSAs that some people might think of when they think of this kind of farming. I mean, we're talking about larger farms and people who are growing row crops, right?
Right, and I think that is really exciting. That that there are farmers who went into conventional farming because they wanted to make a living, and they discovered that their land wasn't resilient enough to stand up to the challenges of changing weather, to stand up to many challenges. And they are discovering that working with nature, working with these natural partnerships, they can make more money and have a more satisfying life on their farms. I wanted to speak to what Paul had said about changes that he saw in his soil because of the cover crops. You know, the one of the things that those roots in the ground do, that when the plants change carbon dioxide into carbon fuel and shoot that down to their roots, those soil microorganisms, one of the things that they're doing with that carbon fuel is that they make a carbon glue to create habitat in the soil. So they're taking that carbon glue and putting together a piece of sand and a piece of silt and maybe a tiny little piece of a stem and creating habitat for themselves to protect them from other microorganisms and to control the flow of water and air in the soil. But what that winds up doing is creating this coral reef structure to the soil. And so that soil that has that deep, deep coral reef structure, and when I was on Gabe Brown's farm, you know, we were walking around through one of his cornfields, and he had a moisture probe, a 4-foot-long metal moisture probe, and he bent over at one point and shoved that straight down to his knuckles. And I was able to do the same thing. So that says so much about the structure of his soil and that honeycombed coral reef structure there. You know, somebody who has that structure to their soil doesn't need to be as concerned about rainfall, you know, because they know that when it does rain, that soil is going to soak up that rainfall. It's not just going to run away. One of the things that was most dramatic about Gabe Brown's farm is that he went from, so he's had that property for 15 years, but he hasn't always been doing the kind of stuff he's doing now. It was a learning process because he was one of the pioneers, but his soil went from an infiltration rate of 0.5 inch per hour to 8 inches in an hour. So that's a really dramatic change.
And he said he doesn't fear drought.
He doesn't. That's what he says. He says he doesn't fear drought.
I want to get to the phones. Dinah is on the line in Ames. Hi, Dinah.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I grew up in Nebraska, and there was lots of emphasis on planting windbreaks. And just a few weeks ago, we were back in Nebraska, and I saw a lot of newer windbreaks being planted. I'm wondering if either of your guests today have given any thought to windbreaks and how they might add to, or whether or not the other things they're doing are of more value than windbreaks, because I'm seeing a lot of them being ripped out in Iowa. And with the drought and the winds last year, I thought, boy, we could use a few.
Thank you so much for your call, Dinah. And Paul, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, I grew up in a house with a great windbreak, and I really appreciated it. We still go down to keep livestock down there in the winter. It's always warmer there than it is where we live. When I came home from the service, I thought a chainsaw was the greatest tool ever invented, and I sawed down a lot of trees. And the way the house is situated, there's no way we can really plant a windbreak without practically being right in the road ditch. But I think they're great. I really do.
And
I think they serve a great purpose.
Right. And Kristen, do you see that as part of this movement as well?
I don't necessarily see it as part of this movement, or I haven't documented it as part of this movement, but they seem to be a great idea. And again, anything that's putting more roots in the soil is a good thing.
Right. And we just have a couple of minutes left. And Kristen, I don't get the sense that you're trying to place responsibility for global climate change on the shoulders of farmers, although I'm sure there are people who could interpret this that way. But when we talk about what farmers can do to change their practices, you see a lot of benefits for farmers, not just for the planet. This is not just a solution to global climate change, but you think that this is beneficial to everyone.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that was really exciting for me is that I spoke to lots of farmers in several parts of the world, and, you know, there were some who didn't believe in climate change, global warming at all. They thought that it was occurring, but they didn't think that it was the result of human activities. Nevertheless, they were completely dedicated to their own soil health, to doing all the things that Paul is talking about and that Gabe Brown does and that these other regenerative farmers are doing. And they were very interested in it because it was making their farms healthier, it was making their work easier, it was making their profits higher.
And on the subject of global climate change, do you really believe that if there is a movement in agriculture that it could actually reverse climate change?
I believe that it could draw down the carbon dioxide that is in the atmosphere to a point where we don't have to worry about that part. I think we're still going to have to worry about some of the changes that are already underway from the warming that is already occurring. But I don't think that there's any doubt that the way we use our land, agriculture being the biggest way that we use our land, can really dramatically change the kind of carbon load that we have in our skies.
What kind of buy-in would it take to see a difference?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by buy-in.
What percentage of farmers changing their practices?
I can point you to some research that's being done in New Mexico by a molecular biologist named David Johnson. And what he's doing is he's working with land, doing this intensive no-till and cover cropping, and seeing the carbon capacity of the soils just skyrocket. And what he says is if 11% of the world's croplands, and apparently more cropland than that is fallow every year, but if only 11% of the world's croplands were following these steps, that we could sequester carbon in the soil that is equal to the global emissions. So that's pretty dramatic.
That is dramatic. Are you finding that a lot of people are getting interested in this idea? Are you hearing from a lot of people responding to your book?
Oh, yeah. I get a lot of emails every day because it's really exciting news. I think for a long time we have looked at our environment in a really narrow way. You know, we've only been looking at the stuff that's going on above ground. And really the science in the last couple of decades that's been revealing these complicated relationships and processes that are going on underground with soil microorganisms, sometimes as far as 20 miles down, and how much influence that has on everything that goes on above ground. That's really exciting stuff to understand that our environment is so much more complex than we thought, and that there is potential,
Kristen,
there to work with that complexity.
Thank you so much. Kristen Olson is the author of The Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. And thank you to Paul Ackley from Taylor County. This is Talk of Iowa.